Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in African Studies. I'm Jacob Ivey, one of the hosts of this channel on the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking with Nancy Mitchell about her new book, Jimmy Carter in Africa, Race and the Cold War, published by Stanford University Press in 2016 as part of the Cold War International History Project series. Nancy Mitchell is a professor of history at North Carolina State University, and her book provides probably one of the most complete pictures of the Carter administration's dealings with the African continent and its legacies for U.S. and international policy across the globe. Nancy Mitchell, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jacob. It's really a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you. And Nancy, we were wondering if you could start a bit and tell us about yourself and how you came to the field of history.
That could be a very long answer, but I'll try to be brief. I wasn't really interested in history until I lived abroad in the 1970s for 10 years. I lived in Ireland and Egypt. And it was there that I got really fascinated by trying to understand U.S. foreign policy. And so I came back from living abroad, did my PhD at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and really moved as I was doing that from a more political science point of view to a more historical point of view.
I think we talk to a lot of people when we deal with the Cold War, they sort of make that transition from that process. And yeah, I think your international experience really shines in this book itself. And I would have to say for our audience, this is a tome, and that is not a negative claim whatsoever, but this is a massive book about Carter in Africa. So I just have to ask, how did this start? How did this project begin, looking at Carter in Africa?
Oh, gosh. Well, certainly that's true. It is a tome. It was initially going to be one chapter, and probably a short chapter, in an overall book studying Carter's foreign policy. Pretty soon after starting the research, after about 2 years, I guess, of doing the research for that book, I realized that, I mean, that would have been like a series of tomes. And so I decided to begin with Africa, and then I thought I'd write other books about Carter in other regions. But I started to begin with Africa because people, I think, often forget, not maybe the listeners to this podcast, but a lot of people forget how important Africa was in the Cold War in the 1970s. Carter told me when I interviewed him that he spent more time and effort on Africa than he did on the Middle East. And I think that the documentary record supports that. Carter personally was very involved in his Africa policy, whereas in the Middle East, you know, the State Department carried a lot of that burden, and it did also in Africa, but Carter really paid a lot of attention to Africa. The other reason that I decided to work on Africa was that it hasn't really been thoroughly studied before, and there had been a lot of attention to Carter in Iran and Carter in the Middle East, some Carter in Panama. But Africa really didn't seem to be fully plumbed. And the third reason that I settled on Africa was really personal. I had friends who got me fascinated in the subject. When I was at SAIS, I had Piero Glahesis as a professor, and he's now a friend. And he was the first person who taught me about Carter in Africa. And then as I started to do research on the book, I started to interview some of the people involved in the Africa policy. And I just found them fascinating. So I decided to focus just on Carter in Africa.
And I think we are all rewarded because of it on that front. So you say in the book that by 1976, the Cold War was hottest in South Africa. What made this area of the world such an important location for the United States and the Soviet Union in this wider Cold War context?
Well, I think the first and main thing is that Portugal had been very slow to decolonize. And In 1974, with the revolution, the Carnation Revolution in Portugal, you have the belated decolonization of the African colonies, of the Portuguese African colonies. And in one way, you can look at the Cold War as a long struggle for hegemony, for influence in the decolonized regions. And so what happens when Portugal decolonizes Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau, Sao Tome, and Principe, is that you have the classic Cold War struggle for influence in those regions. And it focuses on Angola, where you have a civil war that erupts in the wake of decolonization, and the intervention of the South Africans, who are supported by the United States, and then this massive Cuban intervention that Piero Gracias has described so well in his books. And so the Cuban intervention in Angola in 1975, early 1976, was seen in the United States by the Ford administration as a projection of Soviet power. And so it was seen there as, the Cubans were seen incorrectly, in my opinion, as Soviet proxies. And it was really seen in the United States as a frightening expansion of the Soviet ability to project power outside of its borders in a way that it hadn't done before, using Cuban troops. So that's really why the Cold War settled in the region in the Carter, in the Ford and Carter periods.
And that leads to my next question. You have Henry Kissinger, who's really a key figure in the background of this story and the foreground for a lot of it. But there's a great quote you have by Kissinger who said, "But this is Africa, and one can never count on anything until it is completed," which is probably the most Kissinger-esque, quote you can come up with on that front. But I think what shines so clearly in this book is that there's a great deal of continuity between Kissinger / Ford's policy in Africa and the Carter administration. So how much did Carter inherit Kissinger's policy when he comes to the presidency in 1977? And in what ways did Carter make it his own?
Jacob, that's a fun question. First of all, let me say, Kissinger, for a while we were going to put Kissinger in the title because he is a really important player, but then the title got too long, and so we dropped him out of the title. But he is a really important player and a really fascinating. And the story of Kissinger's policy in 1976 in Rhodesia really hadn't been told thoroughly before either, and I found that totally fascinating. There's more continuity between Carter and Ford, or Carter and Kissinger, however you want to say it, than most people acknowledge. I think people mistakenly think of Carter in terms of human rights and a kind of wishy-washy, weak, liberal view of the world. And one of the things that my research uncovered for me was that Carter really was a very conservative cold warrior in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways. And his focus on Rhodesia, Southern Africa in general, but Rhodesia in particular, was motivated in part by exactly the same concerns that Kissinger had, which was that the United States was really in a box. If they couldn't end the civil war or the insurgency in Rhodesia, then the guerrillas, the Patriotic Front, might call on the Cubans, who were still, there were about 30,000 still in troops in Angola. And if the Patriotic Front called on the Cubans for help, fighting against the illegal, racist Ian Smith regime that was in power in Rhodesia, the American administration would be totally checkmated, because they couldn't support, particularly Carter, couldn't support Ian Smith. That just was a bridge too far. But they also couldn't support Marxist, Soviet-supported guerrillas, insurgents. And so the goal of both the Kissinger and the Carter policy was to try to create peace in Rhodesia before that terrible nightmare scenario from the American point of view might happen. It's also true that Carter, I think, to the extent one can judge anybody's sincerity, was sincerely interested in trying to create a more just situation in Rhodesia, a situation of majority rule for moral reasons. But that alone would not have explained the intense interest that he showed in it.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating to see how Carter comes in and again sort of makes this his own, and yet he's still, as you said before, working within this box that the Cold War creates in this environment. As part of this making it his own, I think a fascinating component as well is the people that Carter surrounds himself with that influences policy. I'm thinking of specifically people like Andrew Young, the UN ambassador, Cyrus Vance, Secretary of State, and Byzinti, the National Security Advisor. What did these individuals bring to the table, and how do you think they influence Carter in this evolving policy during his presidency?
That's another really good question. It's really fun to talk about what a book you've written, you know, so I could go on and on.
Yeah.
One of the things that was most fun in writing this book was to uncover the character of Andrew Young. Andrew Young was Carter's UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And he came to that job because he had been one of Martin Luther King's right-hand men during the civil rights movement. When King was assassinated, Young became a member of Congress from Georgia, where Carter, of course, was governor. They didn't know each other well, but Carter felt that Young would be a very good kind of exemplar of his emphasis on human rights. Young was extremely, in my interpretation of the evidence, Young was extremely important in keeping Carter focused, a kind of realistic view of what was happening in Southern Africa. Young, as aide to Martin Luther King, had been accused of being communist, of, along with all of the civil rights people, you know, that kind of loose talk that, oh, they're all communists.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how the charge of communism was used in a Cold War context. And when he talked to the Patriotic Front, Mugabe and Joshua Nkomo and all of their aides, he wasn't concerned with the fact that they might be supported by the Soviet Union or Marxists. He really saw the struggle in more racial terms and more struggle for justice and freedom. And there, I think, it's Young's influence that helps Carter continue to see. It's not that Carter wouldn't have seen it without Young, but Carter listened to Young, and when there was a lot of pressure on Carter to support in the middle of the whole story, to support a centrist solution, when Bishop Ebu Mazarewa was elected, Young was able to communicate with Carter and to convince Carter, or to help convince Carter, that in fact the real freedom fighters in this struggle were the Patriotic Front, and to see them as freedom fighters, not as communist pariahs. And so Carter treated the Patriotic Front as serious members of the negotiation in a way that he didn't treat any other protesters, for example, in Iran or in Nicaragua. He treated the Patriotic Front differently. And I think there were a number of reasons for that. Race is a very important one. And Young was the one who was able to kind of keep Carter's feet to the fire on that issue. I think Young was extremely important. As far as Vance and Brzezinski go, Vance was the Secretary of State. Brzezinski was the National Security Advisor. A lot of scholars, even before that, of the press in the Carter years, kind of defined the Carter presidency as this big struggle between the hawkish Brzezinski and the dovish Vance. I think that that is a misreading of the Carter presidency. It's interesting because, you know, Carter didn't have Twitter. And, for better or worse. And Twitter, I think, is really going to change the way historians approach presidencies, assuming that, that future presidents continue to use Twitter. One of the things that's interesting when you're studying a president, like I did with Carter, the documents aren't written by Carter. You have Carter's formal speeches, and you have, you know, a couple of incidental things he might have written afterwards. But the contemporaneous stuff is written by people under Carter, and he just writes marginalia on it. And so you really need to work hard to figure out where is Carter in this story. If he'd had Twitter, it would have been a lot easier, I think. But he didn't. And so journalists had that same problem of trying to figure out where's Carter in this. And they decided, oh, well, there isn't really Carter. We'll just write Carter out of the story, and we'll just talk about Vance and Brzezinski, who were leaking to the press all the time. But actually, Carter was central to all decisions. And Brzezinski was more hawkish than Vance, but often they switched sides. It's a mistake to write Carter out of the story.
Yeah, and I think where your book really shines is that it does provide Carter with that agency, with the influence that he uses on that front. I'd like to return back to this issue of race, because you note that Carter saw the crisis in Rhodesia through the prism of the civil rights struggle. What did you mean by that? And do you think this viewing Rhodesia through the prism of civil rights struggle, do you think this ended up being a benefit or a hindrance to Carter's management of the situation?
Another good question. Look, first of all, let me stipulate that I think it's a very, from a historian's point of view, it is not a good comparison. There are profound differences. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think it was very useful for Carter to think that way. And I think Young also thought that way and certainly encouraged Carter to think that way. Carter grew up in what Young considered to be the most racist region of Georgia, southern Georgia, Plains, Georgia, just about 2 hours south of Atlanta. And Carter grew up in a very segregated society. He had his friends, because there were only two white families in the little sort of hamlet that he grew up in. His friends were all African-American boys, little boys. But they went to separate schools. They had to sit in different places in the movie theater. He grew up in Jim Crow and didn't question it. And he was not active in the civil rights movement. His mother was progressive on racial issues. She was a nurse and treated African-Americans with respect. His father was very much a typical southerner in that region and that time. Carter sat out the civil rights movement, saw it from afar. He was in the Navy for a lot of it. And he really had, when he went back to Plains, I think he had a profound sense of how changed for the good Southern society was by the civil rights movement, how whites and blacks were better, how the South was better, how it was just better for everybody. And by seeing the struggle in Rhodesia in terms that he would translate into sort of parallels to the U.S. South, seeing Ian Smith, you know, as a white racist in the South, and seeing the Patriotic Front like the Civil Rights Marching, that enabled him to get out of the incredibly kind of strong magnetic field of the Manichaean Cold War. I think my study of the Cold War is that the elite really need some strong way to get out of the seeing things in Cold War terms. And seeing things in terms of race was that way for Carter. He was able to momentarily, at least in Southern Africa, move away from the Cold War. So I think from U.S. policy's point of view, it was extremely useful, although inaccurate, extremely useful to see it. It made it so that Carter could identify with the struggle. He could identify with something that he really had very little knowledge of before he became president. So I think it was really very helpful.
And I think that comes out quite a bit in the book. There's the opposite end of that spectrum, however, and you touched on it earlier, where there's a problem with that direct comparison. And I think one of the more fascinating incidences that occur is, again, Andrew Young at the Maputo conference in 1977, when he gives sort of this almost civil rights style sermon to all of these African leaders. And it seems to be this culmination of human rights and civil rights and all of these ideas. And yet it also seems to fall incredibly flat. For example, you have Robert Mugabe, who says, you know, this isn't going to work. We've tried nonviolent resistance. We need to use a different format to throw off this colonial regime. So my question for you then is, how do African leaders see this interpretation of the situation that Carter and his advisors have? And how does this sort of influence their interaction with the United States during this period?
I love that conference in Maputo. It's just fascinating. And Young really gets chastened by it, but it doesn't stop him. African leaders, as far as I can generalize, were very critical of the comparison. They, particularly in Mozambique, but they tended to see the struggle not in racial terms, but in terms of independence and basic rights. Kaunda in Zambia was much more kind of accepting of whatever it took for Carter to get to the right side. But for Machel in Mozambique, for the ANC and other black radicals in South Africa, it was an offensive comparison. It just didn't work for them. Also for the British were extremely condescending toward Carter, seeing it. You know, the British knew a lot more about Africa than the Carter administration did. And they were very, very critical of the comparison. But I don't. But to get back, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. You know, I'm thinking now. I actually don't think that criticism of Carter's use of that analogy affected African attitudes toward the Carter policy. Machel meets Carter at the UN and really gives him hell. It's really quite an interesting encounter. He really just criticizes everything about past U.S. policy. And Carter takes it. And Machel afterwards says, you know, he likes Carter. I think, you know, I think they just dismiss the use of that analogy. I don't think it's central to their viewpoint on Carter. I can't think of any place where it really affected their policy or their attitude toward the United States.
All right, excellent, excellent. So I would be remiss, because we spent so much time talking about the area around Rhodesia, I'd like to pivot a little bit towards one of the other major focuses of the book, and that is around the Horn of Africa. I think this area is, frankly, even less well known in relationship to the Carter administration as a whole. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about how the situation in the Horn of Africa, specifically the conflict between Ethiopia and Somalia, really was so much different than the situation in Rhodesia for the Carter administration.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating comparison. You know, they're both in the continent of Africa, but other than that, there's almost no similarity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting counterpoint. The situation in Rhodesia, the Carter administration was very well prepared for. They expected it. They developed a policy. They made it a high priority from the beginning. They had their top people on it from the beginning. For reasons that I never could figure out, they seem to have been almost blindsided by the situation in the Horn of Africa. There's no reason why they should have been blindsided. It was clear that there had been a revolution in Ethiopia. It was clear that Ethiopia was leaning away from the United States and toward the Soviet Union. It was clear that that was going to affect Ethiopian relations with Somalia. All of this should have been clear to the Carter administration. But it wasn't. They didn't plan ahead for the crisis in the Horn. And one of the things that I think is interesting sort of takeaway about the Carter administration is that when they had time to prepare, for example, in Rhodesia, in Panama, in the Middle East, they were actually very effective. In China. But when they were blindsided, like in Iran and in the Horn of Africa and in Nicaragua, they were all so busy doing the foreign policy principles, were all so busy doing what they had planned to do. Their plates were already full. And they really had trouble getting the key people focused on these crises that erupted fast enough. So in the Horn of Africa, they were late realizing what was happening, and Carter really had a very confused policy toward the Horn of Africa. He had a very consistent policy in Rhodesia and a very confused policy in the Horn of Africa, a much more classically Cold War policy. Not quite full Cold War, because I think a more hawkish president, a president who was more convinced by the Cold War viewpoint and more willing to use military force, would probably have backed Somalia in the war in the Horn. Carter resisted doing that, but he winked at allies supplying Somalia, which clearly was engaged in a war of aggression to try to get the southern province, the Ogaden, to try to annex that away from Ethiopia. So it was a real mess of a policy that Carter pursued in the Horn. A really fascinating conjunction. It's African, but also Middle Eastern. Saudi Arabia was particularly interested, because it's almost a neighbor, about what was happening in the Horn, and particularly interested in Soviet penetration of that region. Anwar Sadat was extremely interested in what was happening in the Horn. So you have a different cast of characters. Some are the same, you know, Tanzania, Kenya. But you have a different cast of characters and a different attitude in the Carter administration in the Horn than you do in Rhodesia.
Do you think that the lack of preparation and the like was because of a lack of continuity from, say, Kissinger. You said that the Carter administration wasn't doing well in these sort of these crisis moments. I think, though, it seems, or at least the way you describe it, is even the Soviet Union is also caught a little bit off guard. Cuba is caught a little bit off guard by the situation as a whole. Do you think then it's just not just the United States, but it's the entire international community that doesn't really know how to fully respond to this situation?
I think that the crisis in the Horn, with hindsight, I would never have been smart enough to have seen it at the time, but I think that it's one of the cracks in the Cold War. Not that the Cold War inevitably would have ended 10 years later, but that there were crises that were happening. The Horn and Iran, a little bit after the Horn, are the two prominent ones in the Carter administration. There were crises that were happening that wrong-footed the Cold War players, where it was really difficult to fully understand it in Cold War terms. I mean, one of the sort of interesting things in the war in the Ogaden, the war in the Horn of Africa, is that you had Ethiopians who were backed by the Soviet Union fighting against Somalis, who were backed by Saudi Arabia and by America's friends, if not directly by the United States. The Somalis were fighting with Soviet weapons that had been supplied by the Soviet Union before they switched sides. The Ethiopians were fighting with American weapons. And it just shows how complicated, how really almost breaking down the Cold War norms were by the mid-70s. And I think the United States, the Soviet Union, this was a really complicated crisis. And they all had trouble kind of getting their footing in it. That said, though, it's inexplicable to me. I don't understand why the Carter administration wasn't better prepared. The U.S. Congress, in the transition period when Carter was a president-elect, had two hearings on the Horn and on the crisis in the Horn. The State Department wrote up position papers, the Ford State Department wrote up position papers for Carter's State Department about the Horn. I think it just was overloaded with different crises and information, and somehow or other it just, they didn't put the attention on it that they needed to. Now, you could argue if they had put the attention on it, what would their policy have been? And it's still not clear, you know? Yeah. It was really difficult for the United States to figure out what was the right side to be on. And even though I would say Carter had a really confused policy and in some ways an amoral policy, not quite amoral because they didn't absolutely back Somalia, but shading that direction, actually the United States ended up the winner in the Horn. They ended up getting a very useful base in Berbera. The Soviet Union gets saddled with Mengistu in Ethiopia, who is not a useful ally, very expensive. So I think the United States ends up the winner in that, in any case.
So with that in mind, I'm glad you bring up sort of the long-term impact, because one of, I think, the more interesting components of this book is your examination of Lancaster House, this negotiation actually paves the way for Zimbabwean independence. And if you open any book, Basic History of Africa, Basic History of the Region, and look up what is going on in Lancaster House, it's usually the British who are the primary movers and shakers in this force, and the Americans just sort of disappear into the background. So I'm wondering, you rightly challenge this idea. I'm wondering, why do you think Carter's received so little credit for the United States' role in the eventual independence of Zimbabwe?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the British deserve a lot of credit, but the Americans and the British before Thatcher come in, the whole David Owen Foreign Office deserves a lot of credit. Why does Carter not get credit? Well, look, Carter doesn't get much credit for anything. and there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that Carter just doesn't, he didn't do any of the post-presidency stuff bragging about what he had done or sort of spinning what he had done or creating a myth of what he had done. He Reagan comes in, and then 4 years later, Mondale runs, Carter's vice president, Mondale. And so you have, about a 5 year period when the Reagan team, who are really good at spinning narratives, just make Carter out to be a complete loser, a wimp and a loser. And Carter doesn't fight back. And by the time Carter leaves the presidency, he's alienated a lot of the interest groups that might have come to his defense. He didn't inspire that kind of superhuman loyalty that, say, Kennedy inspired, where Kennedy had all of those people. Now, granted, that was partly the martyrdom of Kennedy, but he had all those people who burnished his reputation after he left. Carter didn't have that. Also, I think that two things. One is that to the extent that Carter's reputation is still very affected by people who live through it, the feeling that Carter left, the feeling of his last year was a feeling of weakness and impotence because of the hostage crisis and the economy. And people remember that. They don't remember what he did or what he didn't do, but they remember feeling that. And so it fits the narrative to not give him credit for anything in foreign policy. Secondly, I think that the idea that Reagan saved the country from, a disaster is a very strong narrative that's believed not just by Republicans, but by a lot of Democrats too. And I think that's been a very difficult narrative to dislodge. So I think there are a lot of reasons that Carter didn't get credit. In Zimbabwe in particular, it gets difficult to want to get credit because of the way that Mugabe ended up. And so Carter didn't really want, once it became clear that Mugabe was not going to be the leader that everybody at the time had hoped he would be and expected him to be, Carter doesn't want to claim credit for it.
No, I think you make that really clear. And it's, again, it's difficult to have hindsight in these situations as a whole. You conclude your book by saying, and you've struck on this before, that the most striking feature of the perception of American weakness at the end of the Carter years was how wrong it was. And I think, as you've just said, I think you give a rather well-rounded summary of Carter's legacy on foreign policy. But I would ask, what do you think Carter's long-term impact has been for U.S. relations on the African continent? And do we still feel some resonance of this period, even within policy today?
Well, policy today is a little tricky. But I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to know in the Trump presidency because it seems like so much there's been such a kind of discontinuity with the past, with Trump. It's very hard to know after Trump what bits of the past are going to be resurrected or not. Until Trump, I would say that Carter isn't the reason that human rights became prominent. Obviously that begins in Europe and the US Congress takes it up before Carter is elected. But Carter as president institutionalizes the importance of human rights in US foreign policy in a way that made it even difficult for Reagan to completely neglect. It can be overstated. And clearly Carter's human rights policy was not consistent. But I think that is something. In Africa, probably you'd have to go on a country by country basis. Carter probably had very little impact in a lot of African countries, but in some, I think he has, I don't know how lasting or not, but he had some impact. In Nigeria, Carter was popular. I don't know in the younger generation whether they're really even aware of what he, you know, of the way that he treated Nigeria with respect. But I think certainly for a while anyway, the fact that not just Carter, but Carter's State Department, the ambassadors and the embassies and Young, and it's striking from an American point of view that this is an administration that does try to rise above the kind of paternalistic view that a lot of previous administrations have had toward Africa. But I don't know how long lasting that is.
Yeah, and that's always a difficult thing to measure, is the nature of legacy and how long it lasts. I would love to ask you, because so often when we are dealing with our topics and we're dealing with the archives and we're dealing with, you know, massive series of correspondence, more from a methodological perspective, so rarely do we have the chance to sit down and talk with the quote-unquote great men of history in these instances. I would just ask you, what was it like having the opportunity to interview some of these key figures who in many instances sort of shaped the later part of the 20th century?
It was just wonderful. It just, you know, my last book was on the turn of the century, 1890s, 1900. I didn't interview any of those people. So it was really a treat to be able to interview people. And it was really an education for me. Interviewing Carter, he was obviously very gracious, incredibly clear and accurate in his memory. I transcribed the interview, and it was in complete sentences. You know, it was really a remarkable interview, and very useful to the work. Interviewing Kaunda of Zambia, I did that with Mark Chona, his right-hand man. That was just wonderful. He sang. It was really interesting to see somebody so important in African history, how careful he was. I kept wanting to get him to criticize Kissinger and Kissinger's policy. And I mean, there was no way he was going to be critical of anything. He was very gracious and generous in his comments, very good memory. His relationship with Chona was fascinating to see. That was just a whole lot of fun. David Owen, who was the British Foreign Secretary for the bulk of the period of the book, was just, that was a great interview. I ran out of tape in that interview. I mean, I had no idea it would run so long. It was just, he was fascinating. And he helped me. It's interesting, when you interview people, it helps you to go back to the document and reread them and see things that you completely forgot, or that you didn't, that not that you forgot, but that you didn't see the first or the second or the third time you read the documents. There was a whole series of quadripartite talks, which were secret, between the United States and European countries that were interested in the war in the Horn. In the American archives, they were still classified, but Owen told me about them. And then I went back and I tried to kind of dig up using FOIA and reading between the lines. I tried to reconstruct those quadripartite talks. And I would never have done that if it hadn't been for that interview. So he was fascinating too. It was really one of the joys of writing the book, was doing all the interviews.
Yes, and it really shows in the content overall because, again, just the variety and the detail of sources that we have in the book, I think makes it an incredibly useful tool for anyone studying or learning or building upon the research associated with this period in the Cold War history as a whole. Well, Nancy, we've taken up a great deal of your time, but before we go, I would be, I think, denying our audience if I didn't ask you a little bit about what you're working on now and what we could look forward to seeing from you in the future.
Well, it took me a long time to write this book, so it might be a long wait. But I am interested in this thing that I alluded to in one of my other answers, which is trying to get a better grip on what was happening in the 70s in terms of U.S. foreign policy. You know, the 1970s are usually, you know, when you're teaching your survey class, you say, oh, this is the era of detente, and you talk about detente, and you move on to Reagan. I don't think detente describes the era accurately. And I think it's more interesting to look at the era as two things, as an era of cracks in the Cold War. And I mentioned those two, the Horn and Iran. But you can also go back to the 73 war. And the 73 war is also the rise of the power of the two big oil-producing states, Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think you can also see the 70s as the beginning, not just of the Cold War. The Cold War is definitely still going on. But a new war is beginning, or a new balance of power is beginning, which is the superpowers adjusting to the new power of Iran and Saudi Arabia. So I want to go back and look in a more broad way at the 1970s and try to get a better grip on how we can understand what was happening in that decade.
Oh, that does sound like a widely encompassed topic, and hopefully it is in as much detail as this book, but it comes out sooner rather than later on that front.
That's what I hope.
Well, thank you very much again, Nancy. We all look forward to reading that. And thank you very much for joining us in this conversation.
It was really a pleasure. Your questions were great, and I really enjoyed talking with you.
Fantastic. You take care.
Take care.